Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Welcome back to the Longview Podcast. I'm your host, Parker Fleming, recording here on Tuesday afternoon, the night before the Grizzlies have a back-to-back home stretch there with the Brooklyn Nets and the Indiana Pacers. So, and unfortunately, we just got word that John Morant is not going to be playing tomorrow night against the Brooklyn Nets, even with this ESPN All Access Day. So that's kind of a bummer, but you know what? The Grizzlies are still a very good basketball team, and it's always good to watch good basketball. And I'm also very excited for a conversation about good basketball here with a special guest. But first, ways to get in touch with the blog and the podcast. The Longview Podcast is a podcast on the Grizzly Bear Blues Podcast Network alongside GBB Live with Joe Mullinax, the 3D Podcast with Ben Hogan, and the Starting Five Podcast. Make sure you get that wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Megaphone, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcast. And Grizzly Bear Blues is a blog under SB Nation. You can find it on the web at grizzlybearblues.com or on Twitter at SBN Nation. Again, I'm your host, Parker Fleming. And with me is a contributing writer for Indy Cornrows, which is the Indiana Pacers blog at SB Nation. She's one of the brightest basketball writers we have on NBA Twitter. It's none other than Caitlin Cooper. Caitlin, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to be on here. This is actually going to be, I think, only the second podcast I've done out of Memphis. So hopefully I don't blow it and alienate the Grizzly faithful from my Twitter account.
I don't think you'll have anything to worry about with that one. If anything, hell, it gets you more followers. So there's a double-edged sword with you. You can either be beloved and gain followers or become alienated and still gain followers.
I think that's the glass half full way to look at it. I'm going to look at it that way moving forward too.
Yes. But first, before we get into a conversation I've been looking forward to having, you know, this is the first year in quite some time that the Indiana Pacers are on this sort of trajectory. I'm looking at their basketball reference page right now, and they haven't had a season below 40% winning percentage since the 2009-10 season. And you know, just the Pacers are—they're just used to either hanging around in the middle or being just a very excellent ball club. So, Caitlin, I kind of just want to get a like, what's the vibe over there with the Indiana Pacers, either the coverage, the fan base, on what's kind of been a slow season for y'all, because you know you'll brought in Rick Carlisle to kind of just turn things around and get back into a winning state. That didn't work. And then kind of had a little fire sale with Domantas Sabonis and Caris LeVert. So how's everything hanging in over there for you guys?
Yeah, I think it's actually been somewhat of a whirlwind of a season because I think they were off to a tough start before the season even started in a lot of respects. I mean, we now know that TJ Warren had consecutive stress fractures in his left foot. So, you know, they knew before training camp that he was probably going to be out indefinitely. And then after media day, you know, you find out that Caris LeVert has a fractured back that was going to hold him out of training camp, and then he missed time. And it felt like anytime he was available, Malcolm Brogdon wasn't available. And that's kind of just been the story of this team for like two or three seasons running now, where they were just never going to be healthy at the same time. And well, you know, we're never going to fully know what they would have been. You couldn't just keep waiting for forever. So I think early in the season when that stuff came out, I think that it made the fan base pretty apathetic. And then they were losing these strings of close games. They've been one of the worst teams in games that are determined as clutch time with the score between, you know, 5 points in the final 5 minutes. And it just didn't necessarily seem like they were going to turn a corner. They obviously kind of kept letting it roll until the trade deadline, with reports swirling that they were at least listening to offers on Miles and Sabonis and Caris, and then made trades. And the fan base was pretty engaged about the idea of fake trades and who might be coming, and that they needed to start losing games. And the trade deadline happens, and I think that there is enthusiasm about all the possibilities that could potentially be there this summer, and liking the move to acquire Tyrese Haliburton. But, you know, I've had fans directly tell me that they're not all that interested in watching them kind of limp to the finish and, you know, go through the rest of this like losing stretch before they see what the team's going to turn out to be. So overall, I think that the vibe has been somewhat down. It's been a disappointing season from beginning to end, with the exception of making some transactions and what the possibilities might be in the draft.
Yeah, it's definitely very interesting, you know, with the Grizzlies, especially here very recently when the Grizzlies traded away Mike Conley and Marc Gasol. We totally understand that. You know, you're not exactly, you know, one of the teams that's, you know, you're not like the Houston Rockets or the Oklahoma City Thunder or Orlando Magic or teams like that. But you have these good players, but you also have these players that were kind of like castaways. You know, you can kind of make an argument for them not even getting another contract after this season in the NBA. But, you know, it's also some of the fun part of the season, because there's no worry or anything. You're looking at draft prospects. You're watching young players grow. I know both you and Mark Schindler have both chronicled that at a very deep level, whether it's O'Shea Brissett, Isaiah Jackson, Terry Taylor, who I didn't know until a tweet from Fast Break Breakfast today, Keith Parrish, where I guess Terry Taylor is shooting 75% from the field since the All-Star break. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hilarious, because he's listed at 6'5" and as a shooting guard. And, you know, the Pacers have had injuries. I mean, even before they traded Sabonis, Miles and Sabonis had been kind of trading back and forth, with Miles suffering the stress reaction to his foot and Sabonis being out for health and safety protocols, as well as an ankle sprain. So they were really having to dig, because Isaiah Jackson had also ended up spraining his ankle for where they were going to get depth at the center position. So Terry Taylor actually played center for them, but he operates much more, does more big things than even wing things or guard things. So you'll usually see him when he's out on the floor as a screener, and he just inhales offensive rebounds. He's a very effective offensive rebounder. And then, you know, when teams switch, he's very good at getting out of picks quickly to punish switches in that way. So you'll see he and Tyrese Haliburton operate that way in like empty side pick and rolls. And yeah, he just finishes well. I mean, he uses his length good around the basket. He has a very strong core, and you know, that's a way that they've hit. Like, I agree with you. I think it is fun to watch some of these young guys over these last 10 or 15 games and see if they can make, you know, short strides, because this is for the first time in a long time. I mean, if you look at the Pacers draft history, you know, Goga's kind of just finally putting some things together, has 5 consecutive games in double figures. But prior to that, he really hadn't had an opportunity to play. Aaron Holiday has been traded twice in the last calendar year, and TJ Leaf plays in China now. So they've never really had a draft class like this, where you can feel pretty good about the futures for Duarte and Isaiah Jackson, as well as hitting on two-way contracts with Dwayne Washington Jr. and Terry Taylor, in addition to also acquiring Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Smith at the trade deadline. So a lot of talent under the age of 25 that they can monitor and at least feel somewhat hopeful about and make determinations about who should be in the rotation next season.
Absolutely. And that's not even including the fact that the Indiana Pacers have 2 top 20 picks this year. They own the Cavaliers pick through the Caris LeVert trade. Whether that's locks in at 18 right now or not, kind of remains to be seen as we just wind down the season. I know the Eastern Conference playoff picture right now is kind of a bloodbath, but You're at 6 in lottery odds behind the Rockets, Pistons, Magic, Thunder, and Kings. I don't know. There's a little bit of ground to make. I mean, if you want to get top five lotto odds and pass Sacramento, that'd be kind of a hilarious timeline. But now they're shut. It kind of looks like they may be shutting down Sabonis after a potential reevaluation at the end of next week. So who knows? But definitely an exciting time for content for the Indiana Pacers, even though it's kind of a lost season by their standards typically. But I want to get into like the most interesting part of their season, and that's probably acquiring Tyrese Haliburton. And, you know, Caitlin, I know y'all probably had the expectation of, okay, a Domantas Sabonis trade or even a Miles Turner trade, it's going to net somebody good. I saw they were connected to De'Aaron Fox, and then just I'm just going to kind of lay out the scene. I was on my way driving to go get Chick-fil-A. I was in the parking lot, and next thing I know, I just see like the big Woj bomb of the trade that Domantas Sabonis is going to Sacramento. It was Sabonis. And I remember I was kind of a little upset because I wanted either, I think Jeremy Lamb was in the trade, right?
Yeah.
And Justin Holiday. I was kind of thinking one of those two with the like a Culver and second round pick package, but that didn't happen. And I saw it was Buddy Hield, Tristan Thompson, and Tyrese Haliburton. So what were kind of like your initial thoughts when, you know, you've had all these trade rumors for months now, and then it finally cultivates into Tyrese Haliburton?
Right. I mean, I think it was a little bit of whiplash because, you know, we had had Jake Fisher over at Bleacher Report on our podcast, and he had kind of indicated that prior to the stress reaction that Miles Turner sustained, that like many people around the league expected that he was going to be one of the first big dominoes to move. And that had sort of been corroborated locally and just from whispers that I had heard around the league, that he was kind of the one of the two bigs that people were expecting was going to be on the move before the deadline, if not, you know, maybe even both of them. So to see that it ended up being Sabonis, our kind of threshold that Mark and I had kind of laid out when we were on the podcast was like, if you're going to trade who in our opinion was the team's best player, that's somewhat controversial in Pacers circles for whatever reason. But if you were going to trade him as a two-time All-Star and only an $18 million contract, like it wasn't going to be satisfying, at least on my end, if like the team that was most notably out there was the Wizards. And that was rumored to be, you know, the equivalent. It was going to be like Rui, Denny, and then they were going to have to do some finagling to even make a draft pick available, right, by removing protections on one of their picks that they owed Oklahoma, that they have from Oklahoma City. So that just felt like, you know, you're going to be returning role players. I was kind of adamant that I didn't think that they should move him until after the summer or until around the draft, because I thought at the very least, you know, you could see if you could do a half measure and still build with him, or there might be more teams in the fray because of what type of player he is. Teams kind of have to do, I don't want to say finagling, but he's definitely a player that you have to plan for and build around. And maybe, you know, a team that wasn't like Sacramento, who I realized they were pressing for the play-in tournament and that didn't turn out, but you know, that's a playoff contender, may not be able to easily blend him into what they do mid-season. And we kind of said that if you're not going to get somebody in return that's either going to currently be your best player or develop into that, why are you moving him? So I didn't really think that was going to happen. And I certainly didn't think that the Sacramento Kings, because as you said, it kept being De'Aaron Fox that was mentioned. And he obviously takes up a lot more of the cap space and is a very different player that I don't necessarily think completely fits with the style and way that Rick Carlisle wants to play. But when you see that it's Tyrese, it's only on the second year of his rookie contract, still has a lot of room to grow and has been impressive in his first 16 games with the Pacers, I that's not something you can say no to if you're the Pacers. And it sounds like not a lot of teams knew that he was even available and that, you know, the Kings definitely had Sabonis circled. And a lot of people have asked me like, you know, well, the Pacers picked a big. I don't really, from my perspective, I don't think that they really did pick a big. I think that the decision was more about we picked Tyrese Haliburton because, you know, we're in this certain timeline of where our franchise is currently at. And he's somebody that we can grow and build with, and having a franchise point guard and where the NBA is today, those don't come by easily. And we think that we could potentially get one in him. So I think that's kind of where the decision went down to. And I think that from all accounts, they're very happy with the deal that they made.
Right. And it really is paying off. At the moment, just from just brief research on Tyrese Haliburton, he's in the top 10 in potential assists while also in the top 10 in assists per game. And I was looking at his stats with the Indiana Pacers, and in 16 games, he's averaging like 17 points, 9 assists, 3 or 4 rebounds while shooting 40% from 3. And I know this isn't sustainable, but the players that have averaged at least 9 assists a game while shooting 40% from 3 were Kevin Johnson, Jason Kidd, Steve Nash, Chris Paul, Mark Price, and John Stockton. I mean, that's insane company. It's probably not going to translate over or sustain over time, but it just kind of highlights the fact of the passing talent that Tyrese Haliburton has. Now that he has the ball in his hands, he's not having to kind of co-pilot with someone. So what can he make so far out of Tyrese Haliburton's passing talent that's really just stood out to you?
Yeah, what's interesting about what you just said is when he first debuted for the first 4 games before the All-Star break, Malcolm Brogdon wasn't available yet. So what you're saying, yeah, I mean, he had a high time of possession similar to what Brogdon had at the beginning of the season. It really stood out how much he was looking to push the pace even off of makes and really be, you know, clapping at his teammates, like, let's get the ball in quicker. Let's go back at them the other way. And the effect that was having on their transition frequency, which had risen up to, you know, modestly, you know, especially by Memphis standards. The Pacers were, you know, 13 or 15th in the NBA over that little stretch when I wrote about it. And now that's kind of normalized a bit back to the bottom where, you know, that's kind of where Rick Carlisle's teams have been over the last like 6 years, including in Dallas. But I mean, that's something that he definitely provides. And you could just see early on how much his eye manipulation makes a difference. I mean, he's not a guy who's really putting pressure directly on the rim. He exists more in floater range and with the combination of what he can do with his floater, the skip pass and a lob pass, like to Isaiah Jackson and some of the other bigs they have on the roster, and keeping defenses off balance in that way. So you'll see him a lot of times using, you know, I'm going to look to the strong side corner, but then I'm going to throw a lob. And sometimes, you know, his turnovers are up since he came over from the Kings. His overall turnover rate is, I mean, I think out of like the last 8 games, he's had 4 more turnovers in at least 7 of them. So that's something that he's got to keep in check. But I think part of that stemming from that his teammates still have to adapt to playing with a playmaker like him. There was a play, I mean, I'm sure you guys probably remember it. I think it happened against in that Memphis game where, you know, O'Shea Brissett is so active moving away from the ball and screening. He's kind of always moving. He set a flare screen and slipped to the basket and ended up getting hit on the shoulder by like a no-look pass that Tyrese threw. So some of those live ball turnovers, I think he's aware and probably knows that he needs to cut down on, but I think some of it just comes from building chemistry with teammates. I think the other thing that I've noticed the longer that he's been here, because Malcolm has been available again, they have been more evenly distributing that time of possession. It's more of an even divide. You'll see them getting staggered fairly often, except for against Houston. They played more of their minutes together, but they're giving Malcolm Brogdon space to still play point guard with bench units. And sometimes at the beginning of the games, there'll be more Tyrese, you know, handling the action. And then at the end of games, it tilts more toward Brogdon in part because, you know, as only being a second year player, 22 years old, he still needs to grow a little bit and what he does against certain types of coverages. So I think he needs to get deeper off of ball screens at times to actually force the defense to commit. And then occasionally, again, another Memphis thing, like when the Pacers were in the second quarter and got outscored by 42 to 24 or whatever it was, you know, Jaren Jackson Jr. was out there at solo 5 and putting length and switching out to Tyrese. And a lot of times he doesn't want any part of that. Like if it's a guy like Evan Mobley or even Isaiah Stewart up in Detroit, he struggles a little bit to turn on the jets and get past and put pressure on bigs and engage with them when it's in a switching situation. But he's also just somebody, I mean, what you're saying with the passing, that by nature, he's not going to take a lot of bad shots and he's going to look to make the extra pass, which I think is kind of comparable with how, I mean, not completely. We know what Ja Morant does as being a high volume rim attacker and highlight factory, but just the inclusiveness that both of them kind of play with, where you can see that, you know, they want to involve their teammates.
Absolutely. I think one of the coolest aspects of it, at least from the Grizzlies' point of view with Ja Morant, you know, you're talking about going deeper and kind of just putting pressure on defense and force it to shift. I think one of the coolest things that I've seen Ja Morant really develop in, he's done it since his rookie year, but it's just really taken another gear, is he'll commit to the drive and then he'll kind of like let go of the gas a little bit and he's prepared to like shoot like a little floater around the restricted circle. And then he will just like fire out a pass to the corner to like Desmond Bane Zaire Williams or Jaren Jackson Jr. And you're just like, how the hell did he see that? And it just opens up a wide open three-pointer, because when your team is in the bottom five in three-point percentage and your point guard is a passing savant that also leads the league in points in the paint, it's going to cause some defensive shifts where, you know, sometimes you're going to have like three or four guys collapse, and next thing you know, anybody around the outside is just open from three. Is that kind of like what you're alluding to in this like digging deeper kind of deal for Tyrese Haliburton?
Right. Because I mean, I think right now, I mean, the difference between the two of them is that when he gets a switch, he's going to be more apt to create space against the big and keep a three. He's very good with his footwork to get, you know, to sidestep threes, be able to create that space. But sometimes even when it isn't a switch, like, you know, Steven Adams might be in a drop and Tyus Jones is really harassing him in rear view pursuit, as was the case in that game against Memphis last week when he went 2 of 10, you know, he might see Steven Adams in that drop and he has, you know, an available avenue to go the rest of the way to the rim, but he might not even look at it. Like, he'll already be looking at the corner to kind of make that pass, and then he'll jump pass to it before he's gotten Steven Adams to commit to what he's doing and before he's gotten that tagger from the corner to fully rotate over. So if he goes, you know, a couple extra dribbles deeper into that big to get them to pay attention to him rather than retreating, you know, to Isaiah Jackson on the lob, I think that will continue to just make his passing that much more impactful, because he already wants to do it. Like I said, I mean, when you watch Jaw, like, I think a lot of teams have like one pet action that you can kind of point to. Like when you watch the Atlanta Hawks, you know that Trae Young's going to run, you know, a bunch of double drags with the two bigs and one rolling and one popping and two guys stashed in the corners. When you watch the Grizzlies, I know that I'm going to see Jaw hold up Horn several times at some point in a game, sometimes several possessions in a row, and he's going to make a different read out of that every time. And when you watch him do it, you feel like they could just run that the entire game and he would keep, you know, they might not make all the threes out of it every game, but he's going to make the right decision out of it. But at the same time, they're going to start a lot of possessions as well with him off the ball, where he might even just be a decoy while it's Dylan Brooks or Tyus Jones or Desmond Bain running more of the action. So even though he does have a very high usage, I think he is in like the 96th percentile of usage this year and does have, you know, a higher time of possession. There is space where he allows, you know, his teammates to do things without completely deactivating the ball that also keeps opponents off balance.
Yeah. And like for Ja, I guess how he typically just kind of operates, and you know, you mentioned he's not initiating the offense every time. He'll let guys like Desmond Bane or Tyus Jones or D'Anthony Melton, or when he's back and he hasn't really been back all too often, Dylan Brooks, those guys. And he's really found that niche by being served as a cutter. I'm looking at the NBA's tracking data right now, and he's in the 95th percentile of cuts. And I think one of the things that you mentioned too is they operate a lot out of Horn's actions, because they have bigs that can do some different stuff while also having kind of a variance in a playmaking. Obviously, Steven Adams is kind of emerging weirdly as this like very fascinating secondary passer, where he's like hitting cutters on bounce passes. He's having a little extra flair. It's been kind of fun to see, especially since with the Grizzlies and their franchise history, we're just used to that with the Gasol brothers. Jaren Jackson Jr., he can roll, he can take guys off the dribble, or he can pop. Kyle Anderson, typically he doesn't really roll too often, but he'll kind of like soft fade to kind of like get a little bit of a mismatch. And then Brandon Clark, explosive roller, can do him, and Kyle can also do a little bit of playmaking, more so Kyle than Clark. But it is very interesting, because I remember having a conversation with Matt Moore, Hardwood Paroxysm Action Network, earlier this season, and just talking about talents like Ja and Jokic and their passing talents, and kind of how it kind of relates to like heliocentrism. And he said, you shouldn't try to lean too much into it, because, and I don't know, I can't even remember exactly his entire points besides the fact that, but I think what you brought up is a very good point, because you don't want to deactivate Ja when he's off the ball, or you don't want to deactivate the other players because they're not getting these on-ball reps. And I think that's going to be very important, not just for Ja, but for also for Tyrese Haliburton, especially as the Pacers are kind of trying to craft how they want to build around Tyrese Haliburton and whoever else. It's just getting a bunch of players who could kind of handle some facilitation on their own, can make reads, stuff like that. So I think that stuff's right there is a very good key to kind of building a well-functioned offense.
Yeah, because that's the difference, right? Like, you know, Trey, James Harden, Luka Doncic, also all very savant-like passers and what they can do and what reads they make. But if 60% of everything's being run through them, and then they're not doing anything on 40%, like they are, Dallas this year has had Luka doing a little bit more off the ball. But a lot of times when you would watch the Hawks or you would watch James Harden in Houston, like when he's done or he isn't running the play, a lot of times like that would end up, like I said, with them being deactivated from the action because they've used so much energy on the ball. And the difference here with Tyrese or Ja is that, you know, they're going to start possessions away from the ball, like what you just said, where like I watched the Grizzlies play the Spurs, and what you brought up about Steven Adams and being a secondary playmaker somewhat out of the elbows, you'll see the Grizzlies do some of that now, where like you said, you're going to enter it into the elbow, and then sometimes they'll run like, you know, a dummy stagger on the opposite side with Ja standing in the corner. It gets the defense to focus their attention somewhere else, and he'll stay in the play, backdoor cut, and then you can hit him from the elbow in those types of situations. And when you do that, like as much as you can watch Ja get the ball at one end of the court after a dead ball situation, and he might be able to push it all the way in transition in less than 4 seconds, you know, off of like a blind pig pass from Kyle Anderson at half court, like he can do that. But if he were to do it for an entire game, would he have energy to? Probably not. Like, so what their approach is and what the potential approach is with Tyrese, again, very different players and how they go about making their passes and what areas of the floor they tend to exist in is what you're saying. Like if Tyrese can get to a point where, you know, he can play off ball because he is the caliber of shooter that he is, but you can also see moments, like I think it was when they were down in Orlando where Buddy Hield, they do quite a bit with three guard lineups now because they're starting Buddy. So you might see Tyrese and Brogdon and Buddy out there at the same time. Like he gets it in a secondary situation, drives the baseline, and he really wanted Tyrese to cut from the 45 angle or at least space between the two weak side defenders and drift over. And Tyrese kind of stood behind the defender because he wanted to stay glued there to shoot the three. Buddy ends up turning it over, and their transition defense issues run pretty deep, but they ended up kind of litigating that when they should have been getting back in transition. So those are just like little spots where, you know, the value of what I said is true, that like both of them so often look for their teammates, sometimes even at the expense of themselves. But if you can be off the ball when they are running actions and still be involved, I think that that not only conserves their energy, but also like just makes for, you know, I don't know how else to term it, but a happier work environment. Like when I read the Michael V. Pina article that he wrote about Ja in Sports Illustrated, like the quote that really stood out to me was Ja just directly saying, "I don't hunt shots. My teammates yell at me if I'm not being aggressive enough," which just seems crazy for the reasons that you said. Like, you know, he leads the NBA as a guard in paint points. And you can see spots like that where, you know, just like I said with Tyrese before, like you can point out spots in each of these games. And it's not like I'm monitoring exactly how many shots he's taken. And these last three, he's been at 10 or less. And it's like, you know, you could take a shot there, but he's going to get into the paint. He's going to be looking for other guys to get the ball. And that's kind of the balance. Like, I'd be interested to know from your perspective here, since Dylan Brooks has been back, you know, how the shot distribution has been, even in games here when Ja hasn't been playing. Like, you know, it seems at times like, you know, Dylan might have, you know, 15 or more shots, and maybe Jaren Jackson doesn't have as many, and how that shakes out. Like, do Memphis fans favor a reality where Ja is taking, you know, an overwhelmingly large majority of the shots, or do they see more of a reality where, you know, it's evenly distributed between Jaren Jackson Jr. and Dylan Brooks and Desmond Bane and Steven Adams? Like, I mean, in a playoff setting.
I would, you know, it's a very interesting, I wouldn't really call it a predicament, but yeah, that the Grizzlies are in with that. And like the fans, you know, I think what we're seeing from Ja is like kind of desired upon for their kind of, you know, he's averaging over 26, 27 points a game. He's getting the right amount of shots per game, having the right efficiency. He's not a chunker or anything. He doesn't take anything away from the other players. So I think that's all good. Obviously, Dylan Brooks, it's very interesting with him because for all his tenure in Memphis, he's needed to be that guy that shoots a lot of shots. His first season, it was a tanktastic team. Mike Conley didn't play most of the year. Mark Saul sat out a lot of the post All-Star break. Dylan Brooks, just somebody had to take shots. It was Dylan Brooks. Second year was kind of a wash because of injury. Third year was Jaws rookie season, Jaren Jackson Jr.'s second season. And then last year they didn't have Jaren. So obviously if Jaws taking 15, somebody else has to take a shot attempt. So there goes Dylan Brooks. And now his usage is still high, but a lot of his minutes have been without Ja. And I think really Desmond Bane's provided a nice enough amount of offensive firepower where it would be cool to see him enabled more. But I think really what you would like to see is more of an enablement of Jaren Jackson Jr., especially, but it's been kind of tough with him so far this season offensively. Career low field goal percentage. It's even lower than it was when he was trying to get back into the swing of things last season, shooting a hair under 42%. He's shooting 32% from three, but he's shooting 44% from three in the past six games. So, you know, silver linings there. So yeah, I think when it comes down to it and when it comes to like shot distribution, it all kind of starts and ends with Jaren, because I mean, you're getting what you want from Ja, you're getting what you want from Desmond Bane. And depending on who you ask, you're probably getting a little bit too much from Dylan Brooks. Obviously, if you're asking me, somebody who kind of stakes their claim as one of the founders of Dylan Brooks Island, then I will say that he's doing just about right. But it really, if the Grizzlies want to go as far as they want to, Jaren Jackson Jr. kind of needs to step in instead of being like a 2A, 2B with Desmond Bane. And even if you want to say 2C with Dylan Brooks, he needs to start being more of that 1.5 with Ja and in him and in Bane and Brooks. This is kind of how I see it.
Yeah, that's what was interesting a week ago when they played the Pacers and what became, you know, the total rout that it was, that, you know, Ja is out and they end up like the shot distribution was pretty even in that game. Like, I mean, Jaren Jackson Jr. had what, I think 16 shots.
Yeah, Bane and Brooks, each
had 12 apiece. And like, you have to take that with a grain of salt because like people need to realize what the Pacers defense is, particularly in transition, and the bigs, you know, were getting obliterated a lot of the time and some of those arrangements, particularly off the dribble against Jaren Jackson Jr. But some of that was just him being aggressive as well. I mean, I think that the more that he gets opportunities like that, he probably needs to look to be somewhat of a passer off the dribble. But, you know, when Ja is out, I mean, I'm sure that what the record is when Ja is out gets brought up a lot in Memphis of how successful they've been, does it? Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
And what the narrative for that is and isn't. But like, to me, it's probably somewhat what the record is and taking into account how different opponents defend. But also, like, it probably isn't necessarily a bad thing that when he isn't playing, guys are getting opportunities to become, you know, do more as a playmaker in certain settings, so that when he does come back and you are gearing up for the playoffs, you know, maybe they're all rising together, like obviously not at the same level as Ja, but, you know, getting ready for the postseason in that way.
Yeah, I think so. It definitely got brought up a lot after Stan Van Gundy's tweet. And I think a lot of people kind of miss the fact that 12 of those games, I believe, came in that late November, December time period where COVID just ravaged the entire league.
Yeah.
And obviously they weren't playing a lot of full strength players at that point, but I also think too, a big reason why that's the case, and again, it kind of serves as the passing infrastructure for the Grizzlies here, is their backup point guard is awesome. I mean, Tyus Jones, everybody talks about his assist to turnover ratio. And when he starts, I'm looking at this right now, he started in 16 games and he has 17 total turnovers. So he's only due for about one turnover when he's starting. And when you're getting that kind of point guard play for 30 minutes where you're having a guy average about seven assists to one turnover each time he's on the floor in that amount of time, good things are going to happen because you're getting more shot opportunities because you're turning the ball over less, stuff like that. So I think it kind of, I think people kind of use it to deflect Ja's case for like MVP or all NBA. And they kind of discredit how good the team is instead. It's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. And some of the, I'm sure that probably some of it too is the difference between Tyus and Ja's defenders to a certain extent. I mean, you could definitely see some of that. Like, I mean, Ja wasn't playing, but you could see how much Tyus was bothering Tyrese at certain points in that game. So I know that the off on off numbers are there with regards to Ja's defense, but again, then you have to look at, you know, who some of those opponents are and were, like you're saying with COVID, like, you know, they held the Pacers to a pretty low point total, but the Pacers also just happened to shoot the ball really poorly in that game, committed a bunch of turnovers. Like, you know, I take some of that with a grain of salt as well.
Yeah, it's very tough to evaluate, but I think it kind of just points to the credit of the Memphis Grizzlies, just how they're built, their offensive system. And there's one thing I want to ask you, and this might be how we wrap up here, is, you know, everything when it, you know, you can have all these great passers, but it all, there needs to be a good system around them for them to do so. When I was doing the research for this podcast, I was looking at the potential assist numbers, and I didn't see John near the top, but one that caught my eye was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, as he is the only player who averages 13 or more potential assists per game, but averages less than six. So like that, but with Tyrese Haliburton, you know, he's averaging about a little under eight assists per game, has about, I want to say it was like 15 to 16 potential assists per game. But just as the Pacers are continuing to build and form something around Tyrese Haliburton, you know, what are some things that you see that they need to really kind of enable him as a passer? And even likewise, like, what are some elements that you think they could potentially take from like how the Grizzlies had developed their passing infrastructure? Because, I mean, around Ja, each season they've been in the top three in assists per game, and now it's finally leading to a top 10 offense for them as well in year three. Just what are some elements that you want to see the Pacers kind of grow in or add to as they're kind of trying to round out this core with Tyrese Haliburton as their first real cornerstone of the team?
Right. So, I mean, when we're talking about assists, especially with what you're pointing out there with Shai Gilgeous and the differential there, like, obviously it takes two people to record an assist. You have to make the shot. And Oklahoma City, you know, has been one of the worst offenses in the NBA, in part because of how they've shot the ball. So if he's passing out to a three-point shooter and they're missing a shot, you know, no actual assist for for Shai. And Tyrese's case, like, even though the roster is in a depleted state, I pointed this out in an article I wrote, just watching how Tyrese was manipulating double drags and how much easier some of those reads were than what was the case for Malcolm Brogdon earlier in the season, which, I mean, Tyrese by comparison has a better passing feel and ability to manipulate and shake defenders than Malcolm does regardless. But, you know, early in the year, they're playing Turner and Sabonis together. So if they're the two screeners, a lot of times, like, Miles can shoot the three, but a lot of times defenders don't necessarily, like, he doesn't demand a lot of gravity. So then both defenders in that situation are going to go with Sabonis, which is going to make that passing lane for Brogdon, you know, more crowded. And a lot of times Sabonis was kind of just being, I mean, by the end of what his tenure was with the Pacers, he was like fourth in the league and role man scoring. But early in the season, that was kind of an abstract concept to a degree because of what the spacing situation was. You know, the Pacers were one of the worst 3-point shooting teams in terms of percentage. And most of the time, if you really watched, there'd be, you know, one, two, three people with 1 foot in the paint whenever Sabonis was out there, which made things a lot harder for him and probably spoke even better of what his production was given what the circumstances were around him. But, you know, when this trade happens, the difference is like Buddy Hield's not shooting the ball well this season by comparison to his own standard. He's missed like 30 of his last 40 threes, even for the Pacers. But teams still respect him as a shooter, in part because of how he presents himself in transition and just because of what his reputation is. So they'll plug him in at times as the first screener. And then, you know, you have Isaiah Jackson as a lob threat. You have Chris Duarte in the opposite corner. That's holding a lot more space so that those reads are just easier. So I think you want to maintain that as you continue to upgrade on some of those positions, or you continue to watch Chris Duarte and Isaiah Jackson grow, hopefully, as first round picks. But also, like, if you look at the roster as a whole, they've been pretty decent in what they've scored in paint points, in part because of, you know, his passing and lob threats. But in terms of just from the guard position, he's not somebody who's going to put a lot of pressure on the rim, and neither is Chris Duarte necessarily on volume. That's not necessarily Buddy Hield's game, even though he has been better at it since coming over from Sacramento. Brogdon has really stepped up in that area, but if they don't retain some of these veterans, because we don't fully know, you know, what complete direction they want to go in. They've said, you know, that I've heard Tyrese and others mention the idea of a soft rebuild where, you know, maybe you're out for a year and you want to be competitive again next year. I don't know if Malcolm Brogdon will be part of that or not, depending upon how they see his timeline, but he's kind of their one rim threat. So I think you need to have somebody as a second side attacker who can complement and make plays for Tyrese and also be available, because that's kind of been the biggest hang up with Brogdon. He's a very effective player. He just doesn't, you know, he doesn't have the availability. And that's kind of something that they have to consider in broader strokes with TJ Warren, Miles, and Malcolm. Like, each of them holds value, and you can point out very clear reasons that they've missed them. But if they can't be on the court for more than however many games, you know, per season, how long are you going to wait on that to kind of come into fruition? But I think if you're looking at just Tyrese and Chris Duarte, both of them as defenders really slot in better working off the ball. So I think a lot for the Pacers, their offense has been there. Like, you can see the bones of that coming together. I think what they need to address is the other end of the floor. So they need to find somebody who can defend the point of attack so the two of them can play off, or, you know, more easily switch with a stronger on-ball defender than what they've had. So I'm sure that sounds like a cop-out when you ask me more about an offensive question, but the reality for the Pacers is that they started the season saying that they needed to address the defense, and they actually got worse on defense this year, in part because of the injuries, but also because of somewhat of what their approach has been. But, you know, if you look at Memphis and some of their passing, obviously they live in transition. They have the highest transition frequency in the NBA. And the Pacers, I think, can do more of that with Tyrese as their lead point guard and be getting run outs. And some of their players are a little bit better than others. I know they have an emphasis about how quickly they want to get across half court, because Tyrese is very good at throwing advanced passes and pushing the ball up the floor, like I said. So you want to establish a roster that's going to be able to feasibly do that, and hope that Rick Carlisle is going to lean into it more. Like, he says he wants them to run, and they've been putting that out there. It just hasn't necessarily been a feature of his teams.
I feel that. And, you know, it's not a cop-out. Here, I'll ask you this, so you can kind of feel like it's less of a cop out. Do you think that with, even in these 16 games, do you think that Tyrese Haliburton has kind of sold you on the fact that he could be the league or the future, or do you want to take advantage of his malleability and potentially get, you know, another league guard down the road, whether it's bought, more than likely probably by draft?
No, I mean, I think when they acquired him, they used the words franchise point guard. I believe Kevin Pritchard even kind of evoked the names of Andrew Luck and Peyton Manning with the Colts, and that they've gotten somebody that they think can do that. They kind of walked that back a little bit when Malcolm Brogdon returned to the lineup and were like, well, we have two point guards and we're not going to have to run plays because they're always going to be out there. But I think that they see Tyrese Haliburton as their future point guard, who they're going to have under contract control for a long while, even if that does mean that, you know, he can also play off ball in some of the ways we were describing with Jaw and Tyrese earlier in the pod. If they were to acquire, you know, somebody like Jaden Ivey, who's a really explosive driver in the draft, or somebody along those lines where there would be opportunities for him to spot up and shoot. But I think I and they envision him as the franchise point guard.
That'd be great, because, you know, Tyrese Haliburton, fun player to watch. Also just a really charismatic player off the court, very available, makes himself very available to, you know, being open about his experiences. I thought all the stuff that he did about the trade, whether that was the old man in the three interview that he did, or I think there was I forgot who wrote out, it was something like GQ or something, wrote a good article about it. But I also do say one thing I wish, I think with the Grizzlies, as far as I think the Pacers, at least in one of these areas, is a little more ahead. So I think they got everything nailed down with, you know, their message is getting as many playmakers as possible so that, you know, they can deploy lineups that have playmakers from all five positions. I think they have that. Obviously, three-point shooting is definitely the eyesore there. That comes with the three-point improvements from Jaren Jackson Jr., but also the sustainability of Zaire Williams as a three-point shooter. He's really come on since February as a three-point shooter. He shot 45% in that month, and he's so far shooting 42% from three in March. That's going to be big. But and in as much as I love Brandon Clark and just what he provides as a role as a paint scorer, I would pay to see a seven-foot lob threat next to Ja Morant, because I think Ja is going to be like a lot like one of those point guards, kind of like how CP3 where, or even James Harden, where those 7 foot athletic big men who kind of come across as raw, but they just finish all these lobs, kind of like Isaiah Jackson in Indiana. Like, that's the kind of point guard or the kind of center that I want next to Ja Morant down the road. Do I want to spend that on a starter? Probably not, but like a reserve big man. Like that's probably like, obviously shooters because of the way the league is and what it just does to the defense when you have a driver like Ja Morant surrounded by shooters, but giving him a guy that's a 7 foot lob threat, kind of in that same realm, Isaiah Jackson. I tweeted it a while back about Mitchell Robinson. That would be ideal next to Ja, but I think so far both teams are, they've really got a nice system going that just enables, honestly, two of the brightest young passers that we have in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good one with Ja because, you know, it just complements their floater games very well when you have a guy who can rise up and catch passes like that. I mean, in part for Memphis, like what you're saying with the shooting, you know, when they get into the playoffs, it'll be interesting to watch. I'm sure they'll play a lot of lineups with Jaren Jackson Jr. out there at solo center because, you know, what happens in certain lineups, depending upon who shakes out in their top eight, top nine, if you have Steven Adams as, you know, a non-shooter in the role spot with, you know, maybe Kyle Anderson in the corner, how much more attention is Ja Morant seeing in the paint? And then if he does spray out and kick out, can those guys reasonably hit shots? I think that'll be a question, though I will end on a somewhat interesting note that a stat that I did look up a week ago when I was writing a preview for the Pacer Grizzly game over at our site is that, curiously enough, transition frequency last year in the NBA, which last year was somewhat of a curious year in and of itself because of COVID and everything that's happened over the last 2 years. But I believe that the regular season league average transition frequency, according to Cleaning the Glass, was 14.7%. And the playoffs, it was 14.1%. And what's even interesting to me about Memphis is when they're playing against top 10 defenses, their transition frequency hasn't really ticked down. So whether they can keep that up and whether their defense can continue to, you know, create, I know you wrote the article about cycles and Taylor Jenkins talking about that and really emphasizing that for the Grizzlies over the season, I think it's going to be super fascinating to watch in the playoffs, depending upon who their opponent is and whether the idea that, you know, sometimes I think that we just kind of latch on to cliches that, you know, the game slows down in the playoffs. And I think that's true in a lot of respects, but at least statistically hasn't necessarily borne out for the Memphis Grizzlies this year against stiffer competition defensively, who you would think would be able to maybe get back and slow them down. So just something that I will be keeping an eye on.
We are all definitely keeping an eye on that, especially me and Joe. We're definitely eyeballing the half court offense stuff, you know, especially since I think Joe in particular has a little Tony Allen PTSD from that 2015 series with Golden State and in the 2013 series against the Spurs where they just decided not to guard Tony Allen. Like, okay, is this going to happen to Steven Adams, who, like you said, he's not much of a role threat, which, I mean, in my case, you know, if that means you're getting more Jaren Jackson Jr., Brandon Clark minutes that kind of offer more defensive versatility, you have a guy that can roll and has vertical pop, then so be it. Also getting a chance to kind of test and see that's a long-term plan going forward. But I'm very interested to see, but you know, that's some very encouraging news. I really hope that we can kind of see them getting out and run, not even just for the fact that that's where they thrive, but just that in a playoff setting. You know, if you can get, especially a guy like Ja Morant in the open floor, it just generates, it's just a momentum swinger. And that's what you need in the playoffs. So I appreciate that light of positivity right there to close this show.
Yep. No problem. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Caitlin, do you have anything else to add? Want to let the people know where they can find you and your work?
Right. So my handle is at C2_Cooper. Like you said, off top, I'm at Indie Cornrows about once or twice a week. We record our podcast over there twice a week as well. And then I'm going to have 5 question answers over at your site on Thursday before these two teams face off again against each other.
Awesome. And we really appreciate that, Caitlin. And thank you again for coming on. And I think I hope you feel like I spared you a little bit of not having to give a talk about a food take with Mark on the pod.
Yeah, we did have an argument about ice cream earlier today. So that's something that people can hop on and listen to.
Absolutely. Yeah, make sure y'all listen. Caitlin's one of the brightest minds we have out there in NBA Twitter, always putting together good work, really good with her X's and O's. Again, I really appreciate you for coming on this pod. You can follow me on Twitter at @Pock_Flocka. Make sure you're reading all of our work over at grizzlybearblues.com. Make sure you're liking and subscribing and downloading the Grizzly Bear Blues Podcast Network so you don't have to miss a single episode of the podcast on our platform. With that's it.